Not Quite Right features discussions that are unfiltered and uncensored and may include themes that are inappropriate for younger listeners. Also, I swear a lot.
Something doesn't seem quite right.
Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name is Ed.
And I'm Amanda.
And welcome to the second Daredevil for the July 2025 Not Quite Right prize.
Mm.
So Daredevils are people who have signed up for the honour and privilege of being decimated on air on the podcast.
What, cut into 10 pieces? Or
exactly.
What is it? Is it cut into 10? Or
no, it's one in every 10 people killed.
Gotcha.
But it doesn't really make sense in this context.
No, definitely more than one in 10.
Anyway.
On that note.
So what we do is we read each story, we talk about the story, we break it down, we share our thoughts, and hopefully we all learn something in the process.
Mm.
Maybe we teach you, you teach us, kind of thing.
Oh, all right, Mr. Miyagi.
So as a reminder, the prompts this round were the word crane, the action of burning something, and the anti-prompt of break the rule, use active voice.
Mm.
And our victim this time around is Exeter Stevens. And Exeter is actually a first time Daredevil this round. So no past history to go off.
Just no scars.
Yep.
Let's create some.
Yeah, absolutely. So Amanda will read your story, Exeter, and then we'll come back and talk about it.
Sounds good. So this is Cleansing Fire by Exeter Stevens. A man's attention is instantly captured when you douse him in gasoline. I smiled at my sister as the liquid struck him. He jolted awake, gagging when a few drops slipped into his mouth. Pathetic. Guys like him are only tough when they're slapping someone around. The warehouse reeked of oil and rat droppings. A fine layer of dust coated the floor. There were hundreds of buildings like this scattered across the city, and thousands of men to punish. Our work was never ending. His steel-toed boots scraped against concrete as he struggled with the ropes. Katerina had tied them well. Or maybe I did. We practiced knots with Father, backstage behind velvet curtains where props sat like corpses. One of many lessons he taught us. Not all were pleasant. Why are you doing this? He said. They always ask the same questions. I let Katerina answer for both of us. Vittoria thinks bad men like you are a stain upon this earth, and she believes in cleansing fire. For her, it's a holy thing. Vengeance sought, retribution exacted. That kind of crap. Me, I just like to watch things burn. Who the hell is Vittoria? I flinch. I'm standing before him and he pretends not to see me. Men like him always have a talent for erasing women in plain sight. His eyes flitted about, scanning shelves and crates past splintered pallets in desperate search for escape. He settled on a battered box of camping matches atop a stained workbench. His breath snagged as he pulled hard on the ropes. He kicked, twisting his legs, ankles reddening. It was useless. You're not listening, he said. I didn't do whatever you think I did. Vittoria saw you. You hit that woman again and again. You're a monster. Katerina was right. I saw everything. I always see everything. A fog-shrouded memory. His jaw was tightened. A fist was raised. A breath was held and the air thickened before impact. What woman? I don't know what you're talking about. I ignored him and walked to the box of matches. My fingers hovered, but I didn't open it. Not yet. Lady, you don't have to do this. His voice cracked. I can pay. My uncle is Hamilton Crane, HC Construction. That part always came next. The bargaining, the promises. They said anything to delay the moment. It was fear. Denial. I slid open the box, took out a matchstick, twisted it in the dim light. The man's breathing sped up, his arms were trembling. Listen, his voice low. I have a son. And father had a daughter, I snapped. He too was a bad man and got what he deserved. Daughters, corrected Katerina. Who are you talking to? He said. His face glistened slick with sweat. His eyes were wide, like every other man we'd captured. You're crazy. Our breath hitched in hunger for the moment of ignition. The match was pressed against the rough strip of the box. The match was lit.
So thanks, Exeter, for sharing your story.
Mm-hmm.
And Exeter's also left us a message, so we'll listen to that now.
Hi, Ed and Amanda. This is Exeter Stevens from Central Wisconsin, one of the contest goblin crew. In my story, Cleansing Fire, there are only two people physically present in the warehouse, the bound victim and Vittoria / Katerina, a person that suffers from dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple or split personality. My question is, did I leave enough clues for a reader to come to the right conclusion? I think if you catch it, the story works. If not, it misses. Even though I had multiple revisions, I'm not sure it came across properly. Anyway, looking forward, well, mostly anyway, to hearing what you have to say about the story. Thanks.
So hi to the contest goblins. I think there's a few, maybe even among the daredevils. And I know there's a whole gang. I'm not sure who exactly makes up the whole gang. I wish I was in the gang. I'm very jealous because I do feel like it's a very fitting title, the contest goblin. I desperately want to be one. So I'm a wannabe contest goblin. But thank you for gracing us with your story.
And the question that Exit asked in this message as well is very similar to the one that MJ asked on our last Daredevil episode, which was basically, if I signposted this well enough, did you pick up what I'm putting down kind of thing? And, you know, off the bat, I did.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Yeah. And I think there was some great foreshadowing in the story that led us to that conclusion as well. So, no, I think that was a tick from me for sure. And maybe it was that process of revising that got it there. Because, you know, that process of revising is really important because as an author, what you're thinking doesn't always make it onto the page. That's how we describe it. Like, it's not on the page. You could have that full picture in your head. And for some authors, that's a very rich tapestry, you know, of a story. And it's only 500 words and you can only convey so many things. And it can be very hard as the author to know when you've missed something, because to you, the blanks are filled.
And we sometimes give like two contradicting pieces of advice. One is...
Never.
One is like, make sure it's on the page. And the other one is trust the reader to figure it out. So yes, those are both correct pieces of advice, but the trick is to find that line. And you don't want to get into the territory of like ramming it down our throats kind of thing.
Listen, at the time of recording this, the Flesh Fiction deadline is almost upon us. It's like the night before, right? Yep. I've spent the past 2 days panic writing my own entry and my brain is so deeply entrenched in the gutter right now that I'm struggling. I'm deeply struggling. So please, I apologize. It's not you, it's me.
Yeah, so you don't want to ram it down our throats. You don't want to, like, make it too heavy-handed. And you don't want to just outright state, there was only one of them kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think you've walked that line very effectively.
I definitely think so. I think the balance was struck well. And I think that foreshadowing is incredibly important to that process because as the, like, it develops and the pieces come together, it forms a whole picture. Yeah. Without that, maybe it wouldn't be so clear. But because you've had those moments where he's like, who are you talking to? And what woman or whatever it is that he has said across the story, by the end, it's like, oh, okay, I get it, you know. And that is the fun part for the reader, the part where they get to connect those dots. And in this case, I will say I was connecting them before the end, which is not a problem, by the way. I don't think it's a problem for readers to feel a little bit clever and like, oh, I know what's happening here. And I don't know, Exeter, you may be surprised to know that we get a couple of stories probably every round featuring this idea of dissociative identity disorder.
Yeah.
Multiple personality disorder, or however you might know it, because of course it's a fascinating idea and it creates a lot of potential for conflict and misunderstanding and twists and all this sort of stuff. So It's like a rich vein of storytelling, I suppose, and we do see that a little bit. We see it pretty much every round of the competition, which is probably why I was able to guess it a little bit early.
All right, so let's go through the story. And it opens with this line, "A man's attention is instantly captured when you douse him in gasoline." And that was a line that actually was called out by Dean on our long list episode. It's a very attention-grabbing opening line.
Yeah, grabbed my attention as well when I first read it.
And it's also like it's a passive formation, right? A man's attention is instantly captured when you douse him in gasoline. It's like a passive sentence structure. And, you know, you could have met the anti-prompt entirely with just that.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we talk about opening lines a lot, that you should name a character, that you should show us the setting, that kind of thing, set up some tension, whatever the case may be. But I do like, when appropriate, just having a theme, attention-grabbing statement kind of opening line.
I mean, when we say you need to name your character and establish a setting, that doesn't all have to happen in the first sentence, right? That's just within the first paragraph kind of rule of thumb or the first few sentences of your story. But one of the other things your opening needs to do is hook the reader. Mm. And that's exactly what this line does. So sometimes it's appropriate to hook the reader with that attention-grabbing line. And sometimes you can hook readers other ways, like with a compelling dramatic question or an engaging voice or an interesting character. Like, there are lots of ways to hook readers. But in this case, that opening line, that's the hook. Mm. It's like, okay, all right, what's going to happen here? And what I like as well about this opening line is how it's bookended as well by the passive construction in those final lines. The match was pressed against the rough strip of the box and the match was lit. So that's a nice sort of circular kind of feeling to that story and a nice way of handling that passive anti-prompt as well.
Mm. All right. So the next line, "I smiled at my sister as the liquid struck him. He jolted awake, gagging when a few drops slipped into his mouth. Pathetic. Guys like him are only tough when they're slapping someone around." So good, like, setting the stage there of introducing who our characters are. A little bit of setting. We still don't know. We're kind of still in a dark room. Mm. And I think generally when I'm looking at my own writing and critiquing some of these stories, I like to avoid this dark room in your mind's eye as much as possible. The risk there when you don't set the stage is that the reader is going to fill in the gaps and fill in the room. And then later on when you introduce elements of that room that weren't in their picture, it can be like jarring.
Yeah. No, I think it's important to be clear as quickly as possible. And look, it's not long before Exeter goes on to say the warehouse reeked of oil and rat droppings. Like, and it can feel really nitpicky to sort of say, like, I bloody said it. And it was like the next sentence, like 100%. But the point you make is really valid. Like, if we're in the scene, if we're in the setting, then we need to know very clearly what that is up front. And if we're going to introduce what the setting is, that clear picture, it's a warehouse, is the first thing you kind of want to say. And then you can look at the smells and the, you know, the other sensory elements, because now the reader is in it. So we talk about dropping into the scene and, you know, "I smiled at my sister as the liquid struck him." We're getting the action already, but we're not able to picture exactly what's happening. Like, and I think that's just a case of reorganizing some sentences there. You've paired the idea of gasoline getting someone's attention and then with the liquid hitting him. So those things, like, work well paired together. But I think there is value in giving us the who and the where. And we say that often. Those are a couple of the elements that we need in that opening. Give us the who and the where really clearly. Not just him. Who is he? And is he tied to a chair? Like, let's just have a clear picture. And we don't need every single detail.
We don't. But look, reading over that sentence, "he jolted awake, gagging when a few drops." I first read that thinking he's in bed. Like, that's why he's jolting awake. And then later, a sentence later, he's in a warehouse.
Yeah.
And it's a minor thing, but it's just when you're painting that picture, well, you want to make sure you build and build and build, you know, develop that detail rather than changing what the reader has imagined.
Yeah. And it's hard to know what the reader's imagining. And that's why we emphasize so clearly, like, setting that scene very, very quickly so that we are all on the same page before the action sort of really starts to get going. So, yeah, just a simple case of bringing maybe the warehouse a little bit sooner and going from there.
Okay. So, yes, the warehouse is introduced. There were hundreds of buildings like this scattered across the city and thousands of men to punish. And, you know, I think one thing that I would offer as a criticism of this story is that it plays out a scene that is not necessarily special or unique, right? It sets up these characters. It sets up this idea of this is happening 1,000 times.
Yeah.
the same scene is happening 1,000 times, different people, but we don't have like a unique, you've talked about this pivotal moment or like a change that happens or something that you're setting up.
Yeah. Why this scene?
Why this time? Mm. Why are you telling us about it now?
Yeah.
And we don't really get that through the story. And I just wanted to call it out as we go through that line. There were hundreds of buildings like this scattered across the city and thousands of men to punish, because that's the image that this we're kind of left with, that this is just going to keep happening.
Yeah. But I like those lines. They're great lines, right? And that's establishing like the characters here or character here. And the motivation, which is absolutely fabulous. I think there's just a step that goes beyond that, which is now this guy, right? There's thousands of men like him. There's hundreds of buildings like this, but this is why we've got this guy. And not to jump ahead, but it's, you know, he argues that he didn't really do what they're claiming he did. But I saw you, but we as a reader don't know who to trust. And so even by the end of the story, we don't know if this is justice. We don't know if she's crazy. And I think those are important questions that we need to know the answer to get the right impact from this story. Otherwise, we're just left like, what was that? Like, was that justice or not? Or like, we need to know, who is this guy? Who is he to them? Is he just some guy? And is he even the right guy?
Yeah.
What I would have liked to have seen is that personal connection. Like, what is it about this guy? Does he resemble their father or her father in some way? Like, what exactly did he do that makes him the target here? Not just like he beats women around. Like, what exactly did this guy do, and why does he need justice from you? Yeah. Why are you setting him on fire? Like, that is very extreme. And so, we talk about making the universal personal. How can we make this universal idea of violent men and getting justice and all the like thousands of men like this? How can we make that so personal that it's in this guy, and it's this guy because of this reason? And I'm here because this is my specific justice that I'm trying to get.
Yeah,
like, I agree. Narrowing your focus.
No, I agree. And really making it all about this scene, because I think framing it also in the wider picture of this happens again and again really does de-emphasize what's happening in the scene. I do get the feeling from the context that, like, he was innocent. He was probably innocent, and probably a lot of those people are. And this person is crazy, basically, and on their own crusade, but completely misguided, seeing things, obviously, and that's part of the plot. And so this next passage, where we have his steel-toed boots scraped against concrete as he struggled with the ropes. Katerina had tied them well, or maybe I did. I like that detail. Like, that's the first step of foreshadowing of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We practice knots with father backstage behind velvet curtains where props sat like corpses. One of many lessons he taught us, not all were pleasant. And I would like to see that relationship with the father and what all that meant. We get like this snippet that some fucked up shit happened, but we don't really know what that is, I guess, and what drives these two, and what drives this character to do what she's doing.
Yeah, but what I want to say, like, I love that backstory. That was so succinctly stated, so visceral. This idea that there's these props sat like corpses, like, that's very Poe, you know, like, that's so fabulous and really very quickly creates a mood in that history for them and implies some sinister stuff, which you then pay off, like, very quickly thereafter to say that not all of the lessons were pleasant. And talking about subtext, like, not all were pleasant.
Yeah.
That's a four words, and that carries so much with it, right? That we fill in the blanks on our own. I think that's a fabulous sentence, and that allows the reader to fill in the blanks. Just building on what you were saying though, Ed, I think there's an opportunity here, like, okay, we're in some dingy warehouse somewhere, of which, you know, there are hundreds. What if instead we're back in the back of the theater? Like, what if that's our scene? And like, this is where you have an opportunity to tie that action with a meaningful detail from the history of this woman and make it more personal. So if, like, because that's a quite compelling setting, backstage with props set like corpses, that's to me more compelling than a generic warehouse and lots of opportunity for those corpse-like props to add to that mood as well. And so I think, like, taking that more, I don't know if I'd call it a more original setting, but that more unique and specific to her setting, and really playing on that might have added that little bit of extra personality to this scene.
Yeah. Okay. So in this next passage, we get a little bit of an explanation for why they're behaving this way. Vittoria thinks bad men like you are a stain upon this earth, and she believes in cleansing fire. For her, it's a holy thing. vengeance sought, retribution exacted, that kind of crap. Me, I just like to watch things burn. So I do like that line, me, I just like to watch things burn.
And again, an opportunity there. So Cleansing Fire is calling back to that title there.
Mm.
I would maybe challenge that title. I like that it's called it back here. Like that that link's made. But again, like if we're talking Poe and all that sort of stuff, it's another opportunity. Like where did Cleansing Fire come from apart from the prompts? Where did that come from in her history? And we don't have a picture of that. Yeah. So, I mean, I understand you need to burn something, but that prompt is fairly easily dealt with pretty quickly. And clearly that's inspired this whole thing, this idea of this guy being immolated or whatever. But yeah, again, could we tie her specific purpose, not just Cleansing Fire, but her specific purpose to that history? And again, you could perhaps use that theatre or forget the theatre and bring in something relating to fire about her past with her father so that we see, like, did she set her father on fire? Did he burn her? Like, why is that the thing that drives her? And in a piece of flash fiction of 500 words, I think all of those parts working together can often be more satisfying than just like, over here there's a fire, over there there's a theatre, here there's a warehouse. Yeah. Like, we can instead have all of those parts building on a single picture.
Yeah, and I think there's some opportunities to express that through dialogue. Like, I'm imagining this situation with, like, this father figure. It may be, I mean, you can lean on some, like, cult-like tropes there. And, you know, maybe she says things that are reminiscent of that cult. And if they're in the theatre and you've got that setting, like, there's elements in that setting that you can use. Like, maybe she's talking to her father over there in the corner kind of thing. Something like that that you can express.
Well, she's playing pretend too, in that way.
With other elements, that's right. So, there's things you can do to develop your scene, which is very empty, I guess, at this point.
Well, just on that as well, this idea of her and this condition that she has. We just talked earlier about, like, one of them's like, I believe in cleansing fire and whatever, and the other one's like, I just like to watch things burn. Like, I like that there's these two very distinct personalities that we have. That's fabulous. I think what I would have liked to understand, because, and I don't know a lot about this condition, but, you know, my understanding is it's a trauma response usually, and that it's someone sort of protecting a part of their brain by separating it from their whole self, if that kind of makes sense. And so what I would have liked to have understood here is, what is she protecting and who, like, are these, is one sister protecting the other in this picture, if you know what I mean? Like, one's the one who takes care of business and the other is the one who was hurt, or are they both just on this same mission together? These, obviously it's not two people, but if you get what I'm saying. So from an emotional resonance point of view, I would have liked to have seen how that trauma played out in specifically their different roles and relationships to each other. Like, even though we've set them up as one believes in cleansing fire and the other just likes to watch things burn, okay, that's a difference in them, but it's not like a relational difference between them. And I think that probably could have been established here and perhaps led to a little bit more empathy as well, if we've got the one who's protecting the other. And it's even an opportunity for conflict between these two aspects of her personality. You know, they could, like, one could be like, no, we don't need to do this, you know, and almost fighting it, and the other could be pushing for it. So, like, an opportunity. I'm not saying, like, it's your story by all means, but it's an opportunity to play with that additional conflict as well.
So then we move forward in the action to, I guess, the man who's defending himself in this scenario. But just to call out the first line here, and this happens a couple of times in the story. So his eyes flitted about scanning shelves and crates. It's a tense shift. So the paragraph prior says, I flinch, I'm standing before him. So we kind of move from this present to the past tense, which can happen, you know, without you noticing it sometimes. So it's definitely something to keep an eye out for when you're editing, to make sure your story is being told in the same tense. It's consistent throughout. But anyway, we move forward into this interaction. I do like the rising, building tension here of the fact that there's this conflict between these two people. We think they're three people, but I mean, I think this is an interesting dynamic really, because at first you read it and you're on their side because you don't really understand the situation. And I think that shifts as the story gets to the end. And by the end, I feel like we realize that he's probably innocent. I'm not sure if you had the same thought at the end.
I was really not clear if he was or wasn't. And I think that was an issue for me, because it could have been either.
Do you think that's because on some level you believe that all men are guilty?
Well, she said, I saw you, like, you know.
But she sees a lot of things.
Fair. Well, that's what I said. I don't know. I wouldn't convict him on the basis of her testimony. But yeah, it's a question, a big, important question, I think, that probably needed a little bit more of a push in one direction or the other.
Yeah, so I guess that's a couple of things you can tweak there in this little back and forth negotiation that they have here. But in the end, they make a decision to proceed with the execution and the immolation. And we find out kind of right before the end, daughters, who are you talking to? You're crazy. Our breath hitched in hunger. I guess this is the moment where it becomes clear. And I think you've actually done this really well. In your message, you've said, like, this is the thing I'm concerned about. That is one thing that you've really nailed in that. And Amanda, you've said that early on, you picked up on this kind of ahead of time. But I think the clues are there where you can pick up on it at several stages. And by the end of it, it should be pretty obvious.
But the other thing is, if you're picking up on it throughout and then it becomes obvious, you're like, aha, like, good. Like, that's the payoff moment where you suspect and then it's confirmed. So that's a good execution of a twist.
Yeah.
I think the difficulty for me is that this twist is not new to me. And as we judge competitions and so on, that we do see this one a little bit. I feel like Exeter did really do a great job of executing that twist well.
Yeah.
But I think potentially the work that went into doing that might have come at the expense of some other things that could have been developed instead. So yes, we've got that great twist, but to me, it lacked that specificity of why these people, why this scene, why these characters, and all of their dialogue is propelling us towards this big reveal at the end, but it's not revealing any more about the relationships between these people, whether this guy did it or not, the emotional experience of this woman. Like, it's kind of all just building to that one thing, which is great. It was done well. But when we talk about how a story executes that element of surprise, that wasn't here for me. Even though you had a twist, it wasn't surprising.
Yeah.
And I think it needed something more. It needed something more personal, more specific, and more character driven to really lift it above just that execution of that twist, you know, excellent as it was.
Yeah. And look, it's funny because we spoke about on the longest episode, the difference between a vignette and a story. And I don't think this is a vignette. Like, it's a story, but it has an element of a vignette to it in that, you know, what you're pointing to is the missing specificity of the scene, the connection with the characters. I feel like there wasn't any change that took place at the end of this. I felt like this could have played out again tomorrow night in exactly the same way and then the night after that. And that may be part of the feeling that you're going for here, which is fine. But just from a story perspective, I think that we need that connection to be made to give it significance.
Yeah. And I think that was my initial comments, basically. Like, I would have liked that ending to deliver more significance in terms of, like, why this guy, why these people, you know, he's about to be set on fire, which is extremely dramatic, which is great, by the way. Like, I love all the drama of this. The dialogue's great, all of that. But yeah, why this guy and is he even guilty? All of that.
And I think talking about twists as well, like, we talk about twists a fair amount and when twists work and when twists don't work. But I will, like, make one general comment, and that is that, like, your story shouldn't rely on the twist.
Yeah.
It's a value add, I guess, for me. Like, sometimes a twist can reframe or throw something in a new light or change it and give the story an extra dimension, but it needs to have, like, that underlying character. It needs to have that underlying emotional connection. And again, when we talk about emotional connection, it's not like it has to be a sob story. It just has to have characters who connect emotionally in one way or another.
Yeah, and they feel real and they feel like a person.
Yeah, you have to be able to empathize, inhabit them in some way, I guess.
Yeah, they're not a character type. Yeah. They are a person.
And I think that's a risk of writing to a twist is that, you know, you can focus on that twist and make the twist work and that can be effective. And I think the twist here is done very well, but you still do need all of those other elements to underlie that twist.
Yeah. So I think potentially what you could do with this story is give it another pass because we've got the structure there. It's great. Like, it's all working. And now look at opportunities for injecting some of that specificity for this woman and her backstory and how that applies here to this man. So, like, filling in some of those blanks, but also really getting stuck into the emotional connection of this. Like, we see him reacting, he's scared and whatnot, but, like, how is she feeling? And we're not really tapping into that. Like, we sort of hint at this traumatic backstory, but we don't then draw back on that again later in the story. And I think that was what we could have potentially done. And just, you know, it's a case of just peppering a few extra details through the dialogue and through the action of the scene that relates specifically to that backstory and build on it instead of just sort of stating it and then leaving it in the past. But like, to be clear, like I thought this was really well handled. And I guess what I'm saying here is like, this story is really well written. It's got so many ticks. The sentence structure's great. You know, it's all well told. It's just a matter of then lifting that above. And I think you can.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the prompts very quickly. So for Crane, you've used it in a name.
Yeah, which is great. Nice departure from some of the more common usages.
The action of burning someone was very prominent in this story, probably one of the, I guess, the point of inspiration maybe for this plot.
Mm.
And potentially the anti-prompt as well. Like, this has been classified as a faithful interpretation, as in that you're starting and ending with that passive structure. I wonder also if there was some element of inspiration in this idea of dissociative identity disorder and passive versus active and people being in control of themselves, like that comes through as a theme, as well as also having that faithful interpretation in the actual words themselves.
Yeah. So I think it was a nice handling of all those prompts and drawing them together into like a cohesive story.
Mm. So thank you, Exeter, for sharing your story with us. And I hope that we've provided some insights and some thoughts to consider for your next story. But very well executed twist in this story. And look, we don't want to discourage twists.
Yeah, they can be good fun, right? Like,
yeah.
And this was, in a way, like I'm sick, but like, you know, it's still fun. And thank you so much for sharing your story with us and braving the public critique. It's not a small thing. It's pretty huge. It's the goblin in you coming out, I guess. But yeah, we really appreciate it. And our listeners do too. Like, we get a lot of feedback that these Daredevil episodes are really helpful for people. And so really grateful to you, Exeter, for doing that at your expense, basically allowing all of us to learn together at your expense.
Thank you. And we'll be back next week with another brave soul. But until then, right on.
Right on.
We hope you enjoyed this special Daredevil episode of Not Quite Right. If you have thoughts on this story, follow us on social media and join the conversation. And if you'd like to participate in the next round of the competition, head over to our website at notquiteright.com. That's W-R-I-T-E.
Something doesn't seem quite right.
So thanks, Exeter, for sharing your story.
Mm-hmm.
And Exeter, this is like a Victoria situation where there's another voice inside you. Sister.
Possessed. Victoria's a gassy bitch.
Victoria's what I call my excretions. That's what the word is.
Jeez.
That's not the word.
It's definitely not the word. Emissions?
Emissions. That's the word I was trying to think of.
Again, not great.
No.
Anywho.
And Exeter's also...
I can't for that. And Exeter's also...
left us an excretion.
Oh, jeez. Oh, God. Oh, I'm so sorry, Exeter.